Hello, chaps and chapettes. Welcome to another episode of the Guitar Geeks podcast. This is season 2, episode 3. So thank you for hanging in there while we get through this season already. We are flying through the episodes and it's amazing how quick this year is going already. So I have an absolute treat for you today. So we've had many people on the podcast in, you know, that have been out there and have done all the big worldy gigs and things like that, but not quite as much as our guest tonight. So our guest tonight, as long as been an artist with Lick Library, he has been the winner of the Guitar Idol 2016 and plays guitar for Westlife. You heard that correctly. So I'm absolutely thrilled to welcome Phil Short to the podcast. Good afternoon, Phil. How are you doing, my friend?
Good afternoon. I'm very well. Thanks very much for inviting me on. It's great to be here.
Oh, well, thank you for accepting the invite. I know we've had about 4 preliminary dates or whatever it was in the past, but for things or another, we've finally got it. We've finally done it. Finally. So how has the year started off for you?
Yeah, it's been all right. Pretty pretty quiet start, really. You know, Omicron, unfortunately, put a stop that to a few Omicron. Rescheduled things. Yeah, man, that Omicron, just terrible. I actually got it right before the Christmas holidays, and I thought I was going to have to cancel my Christmas plans, which made me very sad. But thankfully, I got out just in time.
So, that's all right. Was you okay? Did you have any symptoms, or was it, you know, was you?
It was pretty horrible, to be honest. Symptom-free. Yeah, no, it was okay. Terrible. I had, it seems to affect different people differently. Like, I had the slamming headache for like 24 hours that just meant the only way through it was to just try and sleep the whole time. And then lots of fatigue and kind of body aching. Even like getting up to watch a few hours of TV was pretty exhausting. So
I had it sort of at the start of the whole COVID thing. I had it and I remember I was just completely out of it. I mean, I haven't caught it for the second time like some people have, and I hope it stays that way. It's, fortunately, I think there must have been a huge surge of people having it before Christmas. It was pretty mad.
Yeah, people were dropping like flies. So
literally. So as always, when I have guests on, the first things I always ask is for the people out there that aren't aware of you, who are you and what do you do other than what I already covered on?
Yeah, well, my name, as you said, is Phil Short, and I'm a UK-based session guitar player, I guess is the best way to describe me. So that encompasses a wide variety of things. So I do a little bit of work with Lick Library and Guitar Interactive magazine, and I've done a few courses with those guys and occasionally contribute to some gear demos for the GI Mag. My regular thing that I do at the moment, I've been doing for the last couple of years, is writing for Guitar Techniques magazine. So I do the blues column for those guys. And they occasionally throw me a couple of extra things as well. So I did a bonus article on the great Eddie Van Halen when he sadly passed away at the end of last year, which was very sad. So we did a tribute to his life and his work. So that was a huge honor for me to get to do that, because I've been a massive fan of Eddie for a very long time. So that was really, really cool to get to do that. And I'm working on a new project for him, for Guitar Techniques, which will be coming out in April, I think, is when it will come out. So that'll be really cool, kind of looking at who his influences were. So that's going to be really awesome to kind of dig into that. So I do that. And then I also teach at the London campus of BIM as well. So I teach mainly performance styles and techniques there. So that keeps me busy. And then I do sessions and gigs. And before the pandemic, I was touring with Westlife. And then the pandemic came and kind of cancelled everything. So
everything.
Yeah, that's kind of me. And then I do a lot of sort of regular gigs as well. You know, it's not just playing the really huge, exciting shows. You know, I do a lot of function gigs and, you know, various other independent projects as and when they come round. And I enjoy doing the whole wide range of things. It's great. Get to meet and play with lots of really incredible musicians. So it's a, yeah, it's really cool to be able to do that.
It must be, imagine playing, you know, say 6 months of huge stadiums, you know, with Westlife and things like that, and kind of coming back and you're playing the Red Lion in London or something like that.
Yeah, it's a bit of a different feel, but
so, yeah, you've gone to having all your audio done for you, then you've got some sound guy who has no idea what he's doing or what an XLR cable is. We've all been there. So obviously you're touching on Eddie Van Halen as one of the roots and one of the inspirations for, you know, playing guitars. So what was that story like for you growing up? Was the music a big part of your household, or was it, you know, just you heard something and away you go?
Yeah. Music has been a very big part of my family, especially on my mum's side as well. So my mum plays piano and she plays a bit of cello as well. And I started out playing violin, which I really hated. And my mum, bless her, was kind of quite into me sort of doing it. I'd always wanted to play guitar, but she said, try this first. And I'd seen a classmate in primary school playing, and I thought, yeah, okay, well, that looks like that could be fun, so I'll have a go at that. So that ended up being terrible, kind of gritted my way through that for a couple of years and scraped a grade one pass. And then after that, I started having classical guitar lessons because I really wanted to play electric. But again, kind of my, so I think you get this a lot with a lot of parents. If you've ever taught beginners, then you'll get this with children's parents where they go, oh, but we want them to learn properly, you know, so can we do classical guitar? And it really grates me that, because it's, you know, classical guitar is a proper discipline, you know, to be good at that is amazing, but so is electric guitar. And in fact, I would argue it's even broader than classical in terms of the range of styles and things you could do. You know, you could achieve a really high level of ability in one area, but, you know, be sort of a bit mediocre somewhere else, because there's too much amazing guitar styles out there to be able to do absolutely everything, which is really cool. I mean, that's amazing, isn't it, that it's not so, you know, boring, that there's not loads out there. But my dad was a massive Queen fan, and he kind of brought me up on Brian May. So Brian May really was my initial inspiration as well for wanting to play guitar, just kind of hearing those songs in this great searing, authoritative singing lead tone that just kind of put the, you know, the hairs on the back of your neck on end, because it was just so inspirational, so emotional, the way that he plays. You know, he's a real genius, that guy. You know, absolutely incredible.
I think
incredible.
He doesn't get enough credit either as
agreed
a musician, and like everyone says, though, he's a very good guitar player, but I don't think he quite gets enough, especially for his lead ability.
Yeah, totally. I would totally agree. And like anyone who's a legit Queen fan and has listened to more than the classic, you know, function band repertoire that you'd normally play will be fully aware of just how creative and incredible he is. So yeah, I started off having classical guitar lessons from about the age of 9. And then when I was 11, I'd got through my grade one classical, which was the deal, show you committed, and then, you know, we'll get you an electric guitar. So I got an electric guitar for my 11th birthday. I started having electric guitar lessons, and then that was it. I did carry on with classical until I was about 16, but then I had a chat with my parents, and at this point I was studying A-level music, and I said, look, it's a waste of money. I'm not going to go to college and study this. So, you know, I'm only playing it in the lesson. It is of no interest to me. I think we should just can it. And at that point they said, yeah, okay, that's fine.
Can you remember what that electric guitar was? Or do you even still own it?
Do you know what? I don't. And I kind of wish that I still did now, because it would actually be quite cool to still have the very first thing you ever played. But it was one of those original Squire starter packs. So it was a black Strat, 3 single coils that went microphonic within about a year. So even on those, you know, those tiny little Squire amps that you get with them. You know, sounds like a broken radio.
Was it Fender Champion or whatever they were called? Something like that.
Yes, I can't remember. It was something like that. It was so long ago now. But it was that sort of typical type of thing. And it was great. I mean, I loved it because it was an electric guitar and I could make loads of noise on it. And, you know, that was kind of cool.
It's like when I've done guitar lessons and helped, you know, when people have started wanting to play, I think everybody has the expectation that they're going to go through, like, you know, Twinkle Twinkle Little Star and Happy Birthday and all the boring things. But I've always said, what do you enjoy playing? So they might say, you know, or what do you enjoy listening to? And they say Queen or Metallica or, you know, Bon Jovi, whatever. And then I would say, okay, we'll learn, you know, something by Metallica or something, because I feel like, especially if you learn something that you hear and you go, oh, I can play Enter Sandman or Sabotage or whatever, I feel like as a musician you kind of get more of that joy from it, and you will stick at it because you can play something that you've always gone, oh.
Yeah, totally.
Which blows your mind.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, I think we all remember that feeling of when we could first sort of play something that we absolutely idolised. Like, oh, my days, I can't believe, like, I've got the riff down to, you know, Master of Puppets or whatever it is. It's like, but that's amazing, you know. That's Metallica. Yeah. That's insane. How can I play Metallica? That is actually incredible that I can do that. And, you know, that's a really exciting feeling, and that's what you want to chase, isn't it, when you're first kind of getting into playing and stuff. And I think for me, that was the thing with classical guitar, was I didn't care about the music, but I was just pleased that I could make something come out of it. So when I could start having electric lessons and could start playing riffs that I really wanted to do, you know, that's when the bug really, you know, really settled in at that point, and that was it for me.
So you're saying that, like, you know, you didn't want to take it forward to college and, you know, wanting to can it in. Did you have a lull of a couple of years and then you just decided to pick it back up one day?
Yeah, well, it was only the classical guitar that I decided to can. I was very much, you know, wanting to keep going with the electric guitar. So I haven't really re-picked up the classical guitar at all. And the first time I picked it up was when I started teaching beginners and kind of had to do that because that was the gig at the time, you know. And I first started sort of teaching in schools, you know, like 10 years ago when I was first starting out. I thought, oh, well, I've got to get back into this. And in a funny way, I actually benefited from that because it meant I went back to, okay, well, let's go back to reading notation and reading basic rhythms and things like that, because every guitar player will know sight reading is not something that we do. Our instrument does not lend itself to written notation. You know, it's impossible, basically. We can play the same pitch in five locations. A pianist doesn't have that problem, you know. So there's no reinforced muscle memory with learning to read for us. So, you know, we get a bad rap, but it's actually, you know, you have to be an expert in fretboard knowledge before you can even consider reading, in my opinion. Before, you know, otherwise it's just a waste of time, I think. And even with classical guitar, actually, really interestingly, so I gave a lesson a few years back to a professional classical guitar player. He wanted to get a bit better with electric guitar stuff. And I asked him this question. I said, so talk to me about reading, talk to me about sight reading. And it was really interesting. What he said to me was, sight reading on classical guitar, by and large, only really works in the organized classical guitar format that the music is written in, because it's written to make sense on a classical guitar. But it's a transposing instrument, so if you try and sight read off a general lead sheet, it's not going to sound right, because you're going to be reading it in the octave that we read it on as a guitar player, but that's not the pitch that was intended by whoever's written. So there's all those issues at play. And I think tonally as well, I mean, I'm not an expert in classical guitar, so someone out there might completely hang me out to dry for this, but as far as I can tell, in my limited knowledge of classical guitar, that you know, the difference in tone in different locations on the fretboard is much less drastic than it is on a steel strung instrument like acoustic or electric guitar. So it kind of you know, if you play it in a slightly different position, it'll sound a tiny bit different, but it won't be like night and day difference like it often is with the stuff that we do with electric guitar. So, yeah.
I was talking to one of our fellow Pedalboard of Doom hosts when we was doing our podcast last night, and we was talking about obviously some of the struggles and limitations you have as you kind of, you know, as you grow older and, you know, get along and whatnot. And I did notice, you know, when I first started playing, I was like, oh, Metallica, best band ever, blah blah blah. And then as you do get older, you do kind of, I don't understand horrendous here, but you do start to get into what people would say is the boomer music, you know, and the blues and the jazz and the more, I wouldn't say technical, but when you slow stuff down, you really do start to then notice, oh, okay, my bends actually aren't as good as I thought, because anybody can play fast because it hides so many wrong notes. It's only when you slow it down that you realize, oh, actually I got a lot of work to do here. Yeah. And I think a lot of people, I wouldn't say a lot of people gloss over that, but it does. I think it's the best way to improve as yourself is to learn slower stuff.
Yeah, I would 100% agree with that. I mean, when I first turned up at music college, that was definitely the thing. And, you know, in the first year and in the first term, we were studying blues. And I was like, oh, well, this is easy. This is just the minor pentatonic scale. I've been trying to teach myself Steve Vai licks. So, you know, this is going to be a doddle sort of thing. You know, not realizing how ironic that statement was, because so much of Steve Vai's vocabulary is pentatonic stuff presented in an incredibly creative and beautiful fashion. You know, you take like the For the Love of God melody, that's E minor pentatonic, but with slides and loads of incredible expression and stuff like that. You know, it's amazing. So, you know, that was really quite a naive statement on my part to say that. But also, I'd never played a real amp before, you know, like had to, because I couldn't afford one, firstly. So I'd only played on like a transistor amp or something like that. And I'd like had my own band and done gigs in the school canteen or whatever, you know, that whole kind of thing. But, you know, plugging into a proper valve amp for the first time, playing loud and having to play blues, like with hardly any overdrive, you know, a real basically clean, maybe it was a bit dirty kind of sound, and suddenly realized, oh man, I can't make this thing sing. And that was the first big lesson that I learned going to college, in like to learn how to become, you know, quote marks, a proper guitar player, you know. And it gave me a whole newfound respect for players that I would dismiss and be like, well, they don't play like Yngwie, so I'm not interested.
Nobody can play like Yngwie, let's be honest.
No, they can't. And it's funny, actually, because even with somebody like Yngwie, you know, he's the kind of player that divides the room, right? He's like Marmite. Either you think he's amazing or you're just not into it at all. And, you know,
yeah.
And even though, you know, he's famous for playing super, super, super fast, like, actually, a lot of listeners, they miss the control and the fire and the expression that a player like Yngwie has. So even though he plays really, really quick, I mean, these days you'll hear him playing with loads of game, but when he was like really in his heyday, in his prime, you know, he's basically, you know, he's going into a Plexi, which is like a brutal, brutal amp to play, you know, and he's basically, you know, and that's it, you know, and he's playing
one of the most unforgiving amps to play. Because you notice every little nuance.
You do, and you hear every single one of his notes. There's no like mushed sound of, well, it sounds like he's trying to play something quick. You hear everything, like, you know, really immediately. So he really is, you know, a master. But again, he was the kind of guy where I'd be like, oh yeah, but that's just, you know, mindless shredding or whatever. But, you know, everyone has their own taste, I suppose. But
as when what you say, like Marmite, you are the lover you hate, and the biggest one I had for that was when I got forwarded onto John Mayer. And when I started listening to John Mayer, that was kind of my turning point. And I was like, oh, Jesus Christ. Now, I thought that, you know, Nothing Else Matters was a really great example of bringing that emotion forward. And then you listen to John Mayer and you go, oh shit, I'm missing out on a lot here. And I think, again, he's like Malmsteen, you either like him or you don't.
Yeah, for sure. But I mean, John Mayer's amazing as well. He's so good.
Yeah. I mean, I've never heard some of the stuff he's done. I'm just like, I've never seen somebody do that before. And ironically, the first thing that somebody introduced me into was the Live in the Nokia Theatre album. And it's like, just listen to that and do nothing else. Just listen. And I was like, okay. And then within three tracks, I was like, how is he singing and playing this at the same time? It's mad. So can, as like a gear head, would you class yourself as like a person that is really into their gear and their effects? Because I've obviously on your Instagram, we see Strymon's and Victory and Two Notes and Friedman, like Hampstead as well, I think I saw in the background. Like, you have a cornucopia of tone at your disposal that I think a lot of people would sell their firstborns for.
Yes, I am in a very fortunate position where as sort of my career has grown and I've been privileged to do more things, that with it has come the opportunity to build relationships with gear companies, and especially getting to do, you know, work with an artist like Westlife as well. You know, it's a really high profile gig, so it's pretty easy to approach a company if you're interested in something and say, hey, I'm thinking that would be really great for what I'm hoping to bring to the tour. You know, would you be interested in working with me? Just wondering if that would be of interest to you. Because apart from, you know, having discounts and things like that, which obviously saves you a bit of money, which is quite important because you do have to...
let's be honest.
Yeah, you do have to use a lot of equipment to do the job. So any way that you can save a bit of cash is really good. But I think as a side note on that, like, it's pointless having endorsements if you're not actually into the equipment. So I only want to work with companies that I'd be willing to actually save up money and buy the product from. And I usually lead with, look, I'm going to buy this anyway because I need it, but it would be kind of cool to work with you if you'd be interested in that. And usually they come back and say, yeah, okay, that sounds cool. Well, we can do you 20% off or 50% off. Or if they're feeling generous, they might say, oh, well, we can lend you something to try and to use. And then, you know, we can go from there. So it kind of depends. But yeah, I love gear and I'm always chasing tone. I'm always tinkering and always, you know, trying to think about how can I create the best guitar experience, selfishly probably, you know, a bit for myself, but also I try to work as hard as I can to bring the best possible sound I can possibly think of for any of the tracks to that session or to those rehearsals. Because I want those people to call me back, because there are so many, as we've said, there are loads of incredible guitar players out there. I mean, I'm friends with loads of incredible professional guitar players who are all amazing. But I think something that's really cool is, I think the players out there who work in the industry who've really stood out to me have been the guys who they very much have their own recognizable sound. And you know, that's something we're all striving for. And I hope that I bring my own approach, you know, whilst being stylistically appropriate to what that artist is doing. You know, it's no good coming along if it's a blues gig playing like Yngwie, that's going to be really inappropriate. But how do I play the blues that makes it sound like me, or play pop that is how I like to approach things? And everybody's going to have a lot of the same influences for things, of course, but, you know, hopefully... you know, and I can't really comment on this, but hopefully I bring something where people go, oh, well, Phil has a certain thing that he does, and that's the thing that we want. And it's not about he can play more notes or less notes or knows more chords or whatever. It's he just has a particular sound. And I think if you're out there and you're gigging, like, I think we know that with other players, right, for certain things. You go, I really like the way that drummer plays that type of stuff. Yeah, if I do something like that, it'd be really cool to work with that drummer. Or I really like the way that keyboard player hears the synth sounds. Like, they just sound really cool to me, and I really like their approach to how they do that. So I think kind of trying to be on top of gear and get the best out of it is a really good thing to do, but it can be a dangerous rabbit hole as well.
Absolutely. Like, the amount of times it's like, oh, just get that pedal, or just get that pedal, or and before you know it, it stacks up.
Yeah, you spent a grand on pedals and...
Yeah. So with Westlife, we've got two parts of this. I'll say one part being, you know, obviously, how did that, obviously, opportunity come up? And secondly, when it did arise, was it more they gave you, you know, a request of, we need this sort of style of a sound? Or was it like, okay, you get what you need to in order to best approach what we do live?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Let's start with the how the gig came about first, and then yeah, I'll dig into that. But yeah, so I mean, I feel incredibly lucky because the gig really came out of the blue for me. So kind of to go back a few years, when I first moved to London, I was playing in London and gigging a lot with a guitarist called Dan Story, who is an old friend of mine, and he's, I can't remember how many years older he is than me. He's like 8 or 9 years older than me. So he was on the session scene doing sessions and stuff like that. And he kind of took me under his wing a little bit. He, on a number of occasions, asked me to kind of dep for him when he was doing sessions that he couldn't do. And there was only one time where that really came off, which was just after I'd graduated from college. He was playing for Chipmunk at the time, which was a really fun gig. There was loads of kind of solos and, you know, lots of cool kind of arrangements and unison lines. And, you know, it was really fun. Everybody got to really kind of play out. And he had a crossover because he was MDing a different tour. So he said, would you like to cover this? And I thought, yeah, that would be ace. So I did this one show. And after that, he was like, look, the guys thought you were great, so, you know, it's cool if they offer you the seat, because I'm not going to be able to do it next year, then you have my blessing to kind of step into the role. So I was thought, awesome. And then unfortunately, that gig dried up. I think he might have got dropped from his label at that point, or, you know, I'm not sure, but basically kind of nothing happened. So nothing kind of came off the back of that for a little while. And then a few years later, I worked with Dan and those same guys for a singer called Tyler James, who was off the first season of The Voice. So that was around 2012. I worked for him for about 6 months, and it was mostly like promo kind of stuff. And we did like a couple of band shows, and there was going to be a tour, but then it kind of fizzled out, as sometimes these kind of startup artists, sometimes that's how it goes. And then it basically didn't, basically like nothing else kind of came after that. So fast forward to 2016, I did the Guitar Idol competition, somehow managed to win that, which was, which kind of really took me by surprise. Honestly, I wasn't expecting that, but that is the thing that's really, really reignited my own career, because up until that point, I was on the verge of giving up. Actually, I thought, this isn't working. I'm not making any money. I'm not making the contacts. I'm going for auditions, but I'm not getting the gig. Maybe I need to think about doing something else. So I had done that. And then in 2019, the top of the year, I got a call from Dan, who I hadn't probably spoken to for like 4 or 5 years, saying, I've got a gig for you that I can't do. It's a tour. Oh, right. Okay. Who's it for? And with a big sort of chuckle in his voice, he's like, oh, it's for Westlife. I was like, oh, right. Okay. He's like, I think they want to get it sorted out pretty quick, but they're looking for a rock player. They want, you know, it's like foot on the monitor vibes. They want loads of shredding and stuff. I was like, oh, right. Okay. Right. That sounds interesting. He's like, yeah. So I think you'll be really good for it. So can I pass your number on? It's like, well, yes, of course you can. and then it kind of went from there. So I got a call from the bass player, a guy called Freddie Thompson, who is a legend of a guy. He's just the nicest dude ever. And I've got a lot of love for Freddie because this was my first proper big opportunity and like first time ever really doing like an actual tour. I'd done a lot of playing and a lot of gigs, and I'd had a couple of dalliances with that side of the industry, but I'd never been afforded the opportunity to actually go on the road with anyone. So he really kind of took me under his wing and taught me how being on the road works, which was really awesome of him, really awesome of him to do that. But yeah, he gave me a call, said, Dan says you're the guy. Are you the guy? And I said, yes, I'm the guy. I can definitely do what it is you want to do. What, you know, want your guitar player to do. That's my thing. I'm definitely, you know, I'm definitely down for that. And he did a bit of digging on me. So he found the Guitar Idol video and went, oh, okay, yeah, he can kind of do it. And I sent him a couple of videos from some previous sessions from years ago that I'd done and, you know, playing at the O2 Indigo. Like nothing massive compared to the stuff that he'd kind of done. But I just had some stuff to show him. Well, you know, I can actually play in a real band on stage to click on a real thing. And then, yeah, then the production manager got in touch and said, yeah, I've got your number from Freddie. I'd like to book you. Can you just send me a few more videos playing different styles so that we know you can play a wide variety of material? So I did that. And then, yeah, and then they came back to me and said, great, here are the details. This is when first day of rehearsal starts. And that was it. That was it, really. And I kind of find out a little bit later from chatting with Freddie, if I remember this correctly, once we kind of got into the swing of things, because it was my first tour as well, I was kind of really struggling with, should I really be here? Like, I know I can kind of play, but am I what they're used to? Am I like...
It's a little bit like surreal, I guess.
Yeah, it's totally surreal. And I was like, am I the level of guitar player that they're used to working with? Am I, you know, and I was really kind of catastrophizing about that to the point where he had to take me aside and kind of give me a bit of a dressing down and say, you need to get your head in the game, man, because if you weren't good enough to be here, I would have fired you on day one. When you turned up to rehearsal on day one, you know, if you hadn't cut it in a couple of songs, I would have just sent you home. So, so you're meant to be here sort of thing. So, and it was supposed to be like, and it did the trick. He was trying to give me a confidence boost, you know, to say, you know, it doesn't matter that there are 100 other people that might be able to do it. You're here and you can do it. So enjoy that you're here and go out there and just, you know, play your butt off and have fun doing it. And I'm really glad that he had that chat with me because I really needed to hear that. And I think there's not a musician that I've ever met who's never experienced kind of a level of self-doubt at some point, you know. And sometimes you just need somebody else to give you that positive word.
I guess it's almost to say like seeing it from a different perspective.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. And, you know, he made a really good point because... You know, he said, you know, if you don't have faith in yourself, how do you expect the people you're working for to have faith in you? And I was like, oh, yeah, that's a really good point, actually.
Yeah. We can all think about, oh, you know, we would absolutely love to dream to play on a big stage with, you know, whoever. But so when that kind of opportunity comes around, it's not something you can ever say no to, because you'd spend literally the rest of your life going, oh well, what, you know,
yeah,
what if. And take a look at, say, for example, Peter Norre, you know, he session player and things like that, and then I think he was playing with, was it Girls Aloud and Tom Jones and things like mm-hmm. that, and it just takes everything to a complete another level.
Yeah.
Do you remember that first time kind of stepping out and then obviously just like seeing X amount of thousands of people and then just going, crap?
Well, you know, that's a really good question, actually, like, because What happens on big shows and big tours like that is, as well as having the rehearsals, you know, the studio rehearsals, getting the music and stuff down, you also have production rehearsals. And because this was their comeback tour and they hadn't, you know, they hadn't toured together for about 6 or 7 years,
it must have been a while, because I think it must have been probably, was it the mid-2000s, late 2009-10 that they kind of started to dwindle it down, if I can remember rightly.
I think 2011 was their last tour, I think. They did a farewell tour. It was either 2011 or 2012. It was around then. That's sort of when they sort of had decided to wrap things up. So, you know, it'd been a while. And they'd done their own solo projects, but it'd been a while since they'd done it as the four of them. And so they allocated more time than usual for the production rehearsals. Now, for me, that was great, because what that did was it gave me a little bit of a dip in the toe in. So I got the opportunity to play through the set on the stage in the first venue with all the lights turning off and be like, right, now it's pitch black and I've still got to play the stuff. Okay, yeah, of course, I'm supposed to be able to do this. So, right, okay. You know, so it gave me a little bit of mental breathing space to get used to an environment that wasn't used to on that scale. I've done a lot of kind of gospel gigs and playing in church and things like that. So I've done kind of a lot of sort of big conferences. So I'd played, you know, biggest group of people I'd played to would be like 5,000 or 6,000 people. But we're talking like 25,000 people. It's quite a big, difference.
Big jump.
But, you know, like, you just say to yourself, well, you know the songs, you know how to play these chords, you know how to play these solos. Nothing else is actually any different. And also, you're playing to... Also, no one's there to see me, so that's the other thing. You know, you're kind of invisible, which can kind of work in your favour in that regard. You know, there's less pressure than if you're, like, directly in the spotlight in that kind of way. So that, you know, that was actually really good. So by the time we came to do the first show, the only difference was that there was a crowd there. Everything else was kind of the same, so it wasn't all of those things all at once. So that kind of made a big difference to, you know, how you kind of felt about it.
So what gear was you taking with you for that first tour? Because obviously, you know, you're going to have to take in for account, you know, shipping and getting around and bits and pieces. Like, because, you know, it's not just like, I want a twin Marshall stack and, blah, you know, big gig rig sort of thing. You know, I guess you almost had to be quite sensible and having things to suit a specific style.
Yes, that's true. And there was a huge range of styles in their set, because it's classic pop music, and, you know, especially like some of it which was, you know, that came out in the early noughties. You know, some of it is kind of like pop produced versions of what was maybe popular in the rock world a little bit as well. So, you know, they've got a tune called Looking Like That that sounds like a very pop version of like a Blink-182 style track. It's the same kind of tempo, it's the same type of chord progression, and live that's how they want it to sound. It sounds really rock, massive overdriven guitars. You know, it's a lot less polite than the studio version. So you've got that, and a lot of their records are quite stripped back actually as well, especially the earlier stuff. You know, there's not like a whole band arrangement. A lot of it's piano, a lot of it's string arrangements, maybe kind of acoustic guitar. So the musical director, Simon Ellis, who is just a legend, you know, he's written so many number one hits that we'll have heard growing up. Like, you know, he's written for S Club 7 and so many others. I can't remember them all, you know.
The sort of music I grew up with being a 90s kid.
yeah, right. I mean, you know, if you were like me, you were listening to, you know, not, you know, you weren't listening to that, but you were aware that it was kind of around and stuff, you know. But so he's coming up with arrangements sort of well, this is what I think it would kind of sound like live. So he's taken influences from all sorts of different places to kind of flesh it out for a live band thing. So some of the tracks, we didn't end up playing everything that we rehearsed actually. So, but some of it, he was like, well, this is kind of like a Prince vibe. So I was thinking, cool. We're thinking like Quacky Strat with chorus and that kind of thing, like Purple Rain vibes, you know. And then, you know, this tune, well, this is like, we're going more rock with this, or, you know, this is like Motown. So you're kind of covering a broad range of styles. But we also did a Queen cover section, which I was thrilled by because I've grown up listening to all of that. So I was like, I already know it. I know all the parts. This is great. So we also had to then bring like a Brian May sound. So yeah, in terms of gear, the way that I approached it was I ran a stereo setup and I used I used the Victory Super Duchesses because I'd been using the Duchess series for quite a few years at that point. So Victory were kind enough to lend me a couple of Super Duchesses and cabs, and I had a G2 board wired up. So I basically used those as, you know, classic sort of blank canvas type thing, and was using, I think, a JHS Angry Charlie and a Wampler Pantheon for the higher gain kind of rock tones. And then I had the Strymon, you know, the Triple Threat classic.
The trifecta,
yeah. To kind of cover all of those kind of bases, and then was using the G2, Gigwig G2, to kind of control everything, and using the two notes stuff to go direct. And I kind of had the cabs in the hope that, because they said they wanted it to be like proper rock, like hoping that they might let me have the cabs on stage, but I was already wise to the fact that that would probably not happen. So the two note stuff meant that the in-ear sound would be the same if the cabs had to be turned off, and that kind of wouldn't change. So that would, you know, so that would be fine. And it also meant I could kind of tune the tones at home before going to rehearsal, really make sure they were working.
I was going to say, so with that, did you take IRs of the Victory cabs? Because I know, at that point, Victory they weren't like a brand new company, but they were kind of still a little bit up and coming. So was you taking IRs, like, obviously from those, or did you use like a third party IR?
Yeah, no, I used third party IRs from the Celestion website, because at that moment in time, Two Notes didn't have a cab that sounded similar enough to what I was used to hearing, and, you know, with the Creamback speakers. So I found some impulse responses from Celestion of Creamback speakers, which were the closest thing I could find, and they were pretty good actually, like they were okay. So I kind of used those, but since then though the Two Notes technology has actually advanced a huge amount. So the Captor X's came out, and, you know, I've got those now, and they're just incredible. They're a big step up from the Torpedo Live that I was using before. They just had a lot more flexibility in the box. We're kind of tuning the sound and stuff and kind of really getting it to sit. So it sounds really good. So, I mean, that was kind of like a classic sort of session player setup in a way, you know, big, loud, clean amp, get everything from pedals and stuff. But the thing that was quite interesting, I've changed from that, and I kind of realized, as great as an amp that is, that's not actually the right amp for me and how I play, my playing style. Because even though that amp can go really clean, that amp of series, in my opinion, like, sounds best when it's kind of clean, but it's that bluesy, dirty clean. It's not like...
You got to really push it to get that.
Yeah.
That sort of, not the low end out of it, but there's just, I think, especially with the Victories, once you start to push them past like sort of like halfway, that's where they really sing.
Yeah, that's it. And it kind of, the, you know, the whole EQ curve starts to really wake up. And, you know, it's an amazing thing. So I used the Super Duchess for a session with Dalton Harris, actually. And I ran it in the low power mode, even though I was going direct, ran it low power mode. You know, with the drive round like a fair bit, and on the single coils, it was just that perfect, sparkly, slightly crunchy kind of clean sound. And it was absolutely amazing. I was like, oh, this is the best tone that I've like got out of this amp with it. You know, which is amazing. But if you want it to be like Steve Lukather clean and then heavy overdrive, the amp for that is actually the Super Jack. That's the amp that I actually wanted but didn't realize. So that's what I'm using now, and that's what I'll be using on the next tour. And for how I like to play, super pristine, clean, and then really good sort of classic hot rodded Marshall-esque type.
Super Jack,
overdrive.
That's the
V130.
The V130. Well, I run a Quad Cortex at the moment, and I've got so many Victory patches on there, and my go-to one on there is the Sheriff 22.
Oh yeah, that's a great amp.
That with an overdrive in front of it is better than a Marshall, in my opinion. Martin Kidd, whatever he does to those amps, he's a genius.
Yeah, he's a wizard. Isn't?
Yeah, he is. Like, you know, when he brought out the preamp pedal range, like the V4 Duchess, like preamp pedal and stuff like that. I was just like, how has he managed to get all this in that? It beggars your mind.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was talking to Phil Dyer at the UK Guitar Show when we was there. It would have been February 2020. Oh, Christ, that's been a long time ago. And he was demoing the Duchess pedal in front of, I think it was the 35, the copper, and it was just heaven.
Yeah,
absolute heaven.
Yeah, that copper amp as well is amazing. That's such a beautiful sounding amp.
I've never been a fan of that kind of, you know, the voxy sort of tone. That's never necessarily been my thing. But then when I heard the copper, I was like, oh, there's something about that. I guess that mid-range bark that it's got. I say he's just genius. Martin Kidd's a genius, and he likes Father Ted, so you can't really go wrong with either, can you? So how have you kind of been keeping yourself busy through, obviously, because Westlife, I'm going to be touring through COVID and things like that. How have you been sort of keeping yourself busy? Has it mainly been with like the Lick Library things and say just guitar techniques? What has been solid foundation?
Yeah, it's been mainly the guitar techniques column, because that's every month. And then doing a little bit of review work for Guitar Interactive magazine. I did actually I filmed a course for them as well. I recorded properly the track that I did for Guitar Idol, because I just wanted to have a proper recording for that. So if anyone wants to listen to that, they can find that on Spotify. So I kind of did that, but then also my teaching at BIM in London as well. So I was very fortunate to have that teaching gig at the university, because that kept me going. And we had to do it all on Zoom, which was horrendous. You know, the students hated it and we hated it, but that was just the way that we had to do it. Yeah. You know, and trying to teach, if you're trying to teach a performance class, it's almost impossible, you know, to do that. But that was really
especially if you've got six people over Zoom and they're all there with like guitars plugged into their interfaces or something like that.
Yeah, that's it. And you start having to ask them to pre-record stuff on their phone and upload it to YouTube, and, you know, then we'll watch it as a screen share and, you know, all those kind of things. And it kind of works, but it's not the same. And if you're teaching a techniques lesson, it becomes more like a live stream, you know, rather than like an actual class, you know, which can be fine, but then there's a lot more pressure on you to perform as an entertainer almost, you know, rather than it being an interactive workshop and actually seeing if you're helping them or not.
Was when you kind of touring with Westlife, because, you know, there's a long amount of period, you know, where you're on the road, where you're away from home, and you probably get, you know, not stuck in a rut as such, but obviously you're like, another day, another gig, blah, blah, blah. But was there something that you actually learned about yourself during that time that you didn't obviously know already?
Yeah, wow, that's a deep question. It's a great question, though. Yeah, I think it was a huge time of personal growth for me and for my own self-confidence, like in a healthy way, I think. And I think because up until that point, Even despite winning Guitar Idol, I'd felt like I'd had so many knockbacks, gone for auditions for things, but not been the right fit for that artist, and nothing ever really kind of biting. And I'm sure loads of people can relate to this. You have that kind of circle of self-doubt that kind of, well, I know I'm not a terrible guitar player because I can make things sound decent, and I know I can do that, but also I don't seem to be landing those particular types of opportunities when I go to audition for them. So what's wrong with how I play? Is there something wrong with how I play? Is there something that I can't hear that I need to sort out that no one's telling me is bad and I need to fix, and all those kind of things. And I think as well, like whilst I was on tour, I was constantly being really self-critical of my own playing and my own performance. So any kind of little thing that didn't go exactly the way that I wanted it to go, and it could have been the smallest thing, like, oh, well, you know, I kind of just was slightly flat on that bend in that part, and that's really annoyed me. If I was recording that, then I'd need to go back and do that again. And, you know, you kind of get really, well, I get really nitpicky with myself in sometimes in a bit of an unhelpful way. And that perfectionist mindset is actually quite negative, because nothing's ever good enough. And that means you can never go out because it's never good enough, and you can never record and put anything out because you'll always find something wrong with it if you have that really like negative perfectionist mindset. Unless it's perfect, it can't go out, and it can never be perfect. It's impossible. That's not the same as pursuing excellence and pursuing playing the best that you possibly can. That and perfectionism are not the same thing, and that can be quite hard to understand and kind of separate in the beginning. But that was something that I kind of realized at the time, that that's what I was doing. So I was doubting my ability where I didn't need to. And actually, it is healthy if you do this type of job to have the right level of confidence. It's not arrogant to say I'm good at this and I'm good for this job and I can do it. That's not arrogance. Arrogance is I'm the only one who can do this job and nobody else can do it. That's arrogance. Confidence is, yeah, I can do that job. I'm skilled enough to do it. That's the difference, you know? So, you know, confidence isn't saying you're the only one. Confidence is saying that you can, you know, and that's a really important distinction to make. I kind of needed to learn that. And actually, on one of the nights off that we had, Ginger Hamilton is the drummer, and if anyone follows the UK session scene, you'll know him from playing with Sam Smith. He played with Jesse J for about 7 years. He's an incredibly talented musician, and he's one of the nicest guys that I've ever met as well. And one night we were having a drink in a bar, and he just pulled me to one side and kind of gave me a dressing down basically, and said, look, you know you can play, you know you can do it. You need to get rid of this negative mindset and acknowledge that you can actually do this. And that's not being arrogant, that's believing in yourself. Because at the moment you're your own worst enemy. You're so critical of your own performance every night that you're not enjoying it, and that's impacting just the general vibe. So, you know, you wouldn't be here if you weren't supposed to be here. So do you understand what I'm trying to say?
Yes, because I think especially in that situation, you can become so transfixed, because when you know, as much as you've got, say, 25,000 people out there, what, you know, when you're doing a guitar solo, 95, if not more, percent are there to see, let's be honest, you know, are there to see Westlife.
Exactly, yeah.
And not the people that are necessarily played. And it might be that 5% where it's other people's partners that do play guitar or something like that, that do actually pay attention to kind of what's going on. And it can be very easy to lose track. Actually, we'll get round to the point. It can be very easy to lose track and just take that step back and enjoy and take in what's actually going on at that present time.
Very much so.
From a personal standpoint, the only times I've ever done gigs has been in the tribute scene. And I remember my first gig came at 21, you know, so it was relatively late into the game. And my first warm-up gig was playing like this club down in Bournemouth somewhere. And then the weekend after, we were headlining a tribute band festival in front of 1,000 people. And that was like my second gig. And I was just like, what? And, you know, the weekend before, you know, like up until then, I'd never played, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. And then it's only when you settle in after X amount of time, you know, 6 gigs, 7 gigs, whatever, where you can take it in and just go, actually, let's have some fun. Let's enjoy the moment that you're in.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah, it's really, really important.
There's a lot of people that out there that obviously, you know, there's some people that want to do just their own stuff. There's some people that, you know, want to do, say, tribute scene, and there's people that wanting to do session work. How have you found having to sort of, you know, you might have to play something that you don't necessarily have any enjoyment in playing? I'm not saying you have to name artists or whatever, but there is evidently probably at some point where I really don't enjoy doing this, and you have to kind of get yourself through it to move to the next opportunity.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. I think it's I think if you're wanting to work as a sideman, you know, as a session musician, then I think it's about your own approach to it. So, you know, if you're playing a lot of gigs where you're playing styles of music that isn't really what you're into, then there is a good chance that that's going to kill your enjoyment and your general kind of creativity and you bringing anything other than the basic level to that thing because you're not feeling inspired. So it's important that you still consume music and play stuff outside of that brings you that inspiration and kind of keeps you going with that. I think if you're doing a lot of gigs that you don't like, ask yourself, why are you doing them? You know, what's your motivation? What's the reason? Because, and I've had to have strong words with myself about what type of stuff I'm going to pursue playing wise, because there have been some things that I've wanted to pursue, but I think for wrong reasons, for unhealthy reasons for me, where, you know, whatever it might be. Okay, well, I want to get really good at jazz, but why? Why do I really want to get good at jazz? Is that because I want to flex biceps and show off to people that I can navigate the changes? Well, that's going to be a really negative, crippling motivation. It might get you so far, but the players that I know who are really, really good at that stuff, that's what they love. They love listening to it. They know all the artists, all the players. They're excited by that. That's what they'll stick on in the car. It's like, okay, well, I'm not going to stick that on in the car. Okay, yeah. Well, it's good to dig into that stuff because it's healthy for my playing, and it means if I understand how the nuts and bolts of that fit together, when I play a style of music that's influenced by that genre, I'm not going to be caught out and not know the sound of a minor 2-5-1 or a tritone substitution or something like that. I need to be able to know what those things are as a working player. But what are the things that I'm going to really hone? What are the things that I want to be particularly known for so that people will book me for the kind of things that I will feel excited about playing? And that for me was the thing that I really looked out on with the Westlife gig, was they wanted a guitar player who was into the type of stuff that I'm into, which is why I was a good fit for that gig and why they asked me to come back. Because I play in a way where I'm excited about that particular kind of thing. So that's kind of worked out. If I got booked to play for a jazz artist, that would be terrible for everyone. They would hate my playing. I wouldn't really know what to do, and I'd not have a good time. Do you know what I mean? So
yeah.
So I think it's a difficult one, but I think that would be my kind of advice. I think the other thing I would say is try and see every obstacle or challenge you come across as an opportunity to learn and become a stronger, more broad musician. You can't, you know, in quote marks, master everything. It's hard enough trying to do that just kind of for one particular direction, as it were, you know. But take it as an opportunity to go, okay, well, you know, I'm not super, I wouldn't listen to this in the car, but what's happening in this style that I can learn from? What's it revealing in my musicianship that's maybe lacking? Like, you know, if you play a lot of rock music and you've never played any funk, you probably play quite straight and on the beat. You're probably not used to playing behind. That's certainly something I found as a rock orientated player. So playing loads of gospel music and funk has meant, oh gosh, I need to work on learning how to feel the groove behind the beat. Okay, I'm going to go away and work on that. And that's just been really healthy for my musicianship in general. Or gosh, what are those weird chords that the keyboard player is doing? Okay, I need to go and do a bit of research on that or whatever. But if I just take the view of, well, you know, it's not a Marshall stack on 10, so I'm not interested, I might limit the opportunities that I've got, and I might limit the opportunity to broaden how I approach playing rock music or whatever it might be. And I think I feel differently about it on different days. Is the other thing I'd say. Fickle as anything.
Yeah, we all have days where, you know, oh, I can't be bothered to listen to this, and I just need something, you know, chill and vibe. Can you remember when you coming back from the first tour with Westlife, what was the first thing that you did when you got back into your own space and your own comforts? Was, you know, was it literally, okay, I want to walk around the house butt naked with a pizza and a beer, you know. Because you forget all the little comforts when you are away from them for a long time. Like, I know the first thing I would do is Domino's on speed dial.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not really sure. I think the main thing that stands out to me is I really felt the post-tour blues really, really strongly, you know. So it was kind of weird. So I did the last show, which was in Ireland at Croke Park Stadium. Then the next morning, I flew back. So I was like, okay, well, that feels like a travel day. You know, went to bed and then woke up the next day, and my wife went off to work like she normally does. And I went, oh, what do I do now? Yeah. There's no call sheet. I'm not going to turn up for sound check at 3 o'clock. You know, like, there's going to be no nice dinner cooked by the catering team. I'm going to have to fend for myself, sort of thing. You know?
Well, in all fairness, it's a very good point, because it does really, it does put into context as to why so many musicians then fall into that trap, you know, of, you know, where they do end up, say, you know, drinking themselves into issues, or, you know, or with drugs and things like that, because there is that line between, oh, yesterday I was playing to 25,000 people, now I'm reading the Beano on the toilet or whatever, you know.
yeah
it does hit, you know, the reality of the situation does hit home, so to speak.
Yeah, for sure. I think, you know, especially on a tour of that size and with a band that's that big, the whole touring experience is just like, whoa, this is incredible, you know. And a few kind of people I sort of met along the way and spoke to, and they were like, so you've never kind of been on the road with another band before? I was like, no, I can't believe I'm actually here getting to do this. And they were like, mate, you lucked out. You've gone straight in at luxury five-star level here, you know. Like, the number of tours I've done where we've been sharing rooms and, you know, this has been tight or whatever, and, you know, so I'm kind of aware that there's like a stage of touring that I've bypassed just by how things are kind of, I mean, I've paid my dues in other ways, don't get me wrong, but you know, it was actually a really amazing experience. We were looked after really well. So it was kind of like coming home was almost, it almost felt like a step down in the sense of, well, I've got to look after myself. I've spent 2.5
beans
months.
Beans on toast, it is.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. You know.
Are you allowed to name drop any people that you met on the way? Obviously, other than meeting, you know, Westlife themselves, I'm sure you probably had, you know, the times of actually conversing with them anyway, but you know, it wasn't like you didn't have any special VIPs coming backstage, you know, after the gig or.
Yeah. I mean, there are, you know, there are no kind of stories to tell in kind of that regard, you know, I mean, kind of briefly in passing, you know, Louis Walsh is their manager. And of course I recognize him from TV and, you know, he was just there in catering. And one day I just, you know, I just introduced myself to him, just said, oh, I just wanted to say, oh, I'm Phil, I'm the guitar player on the gig. And I just wanted to say, hello, it's a real honor to meet you. I've like, you know, seen you my whole life on TV and stuff. It was kind of a bit of a weird fanboy moment. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of, and he was very polite.
If it would have been me, I would have been like, you look like a pop star. You sound like a pop star. And then...
But he was, you know,
I wouldn't help.
He was very gracious. He was like, oh, well, it's you know, really nice to meet you. And, you know, look forward to hearing the show and stuff. And, you know, that, so, you know, that, so that was kind of cool. Yeah, I think it was just like getting to meet other musicians and players on the scene that the other guys knew who were they were kind enough to kind of introduce me to. So as well as getting to do that, it was a really great opportunity to make some new contacts and kind of broaden my own professional connections. And, you know, off the back of that, I've been asked to do a few other things, you know, which is really great. So that's how I ended up doing some sessions for Dalton Harris. Ginger's older brother is a musical director, and so he gave me a call after that tour had finished and said, hey, I'd like to use you for this, would you be up for it? I was like, yeah, that'd be amazing, that'd be really cool. I think one of the coolest connections that I made actually was we played Hyde Park Corner for Radio 2 at the end of the summer of 2019, so it was like a few weeks since the tour, well, a few months, sorry, since the tour had finished. But we were doing that, and an old buddy of mine, a bass player, he plays live with Clean Bandit. And so he sent me a message and said, oh, we're both on the bill, it'd be awesome to see you. And he'd been the bass player on the Tyler James gig back in like 2012. So I hadn't seen him like since then. So it'd be great to catch up and like, you know, see how you are. And he was like, yeah, you know, Jack wants some guitar lessons. I'm keyboardist and songwriter from Clean Bandit, so you know, can I introduce you to him? So he introduced me to Jack, and I gave him ended up giving him a few Skype lessons for guitar, which was really cool and really surreal. Yeah, and then they like offered me a little bit of studio work and stuff as well. So you just never know, like, kind of what will come round.
So what does Phil do in his downtime when he's not, you know, otherwise involved in music?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm quite a boring person. I don't really have very many hobbies. I'm such like a sort of a guitar, you know, well, guitar geek, you know. I kind of fit the bill for the title of your podcast. Perfectly.
Exactly. That's why you're here.
I'm a genuine bona fide geek in that regard. But yeah, I enjoy reading. You know, so I read a bit, and I've been trying to get back into reading more because I realized I was just binge watching so much Netflix. I was like, I need to like do something a bit different from that. So yeah, I like to read. I like to watch box sets with my wife, which I know sounds really boring, but we enjoy hanging out doing that. Yeah.
What have you been watching on Netflix?
Oh, I've actually been watching Killing Eve, which I know has been out for ages, but I've only just started watching it. So I've been watching that, which is on iPlayer, BBC iPlayer.
Yeah.
I've just finished watching The Tourist as well. That's also excellent. I'd highly recommend that. Really, really good.
My parents keep nagging on to me to watch Killing Eve, but I haven't got round to it, I have to say.
It is actually really good. It's really clever. Really, really clever. Yeah, it's good.
I have been watching Money Heist.
I've tried to get into that show, but I've only made it through the second episode.
For me, Breaking Bad is probably my favourite series ever created. Money Heist is on that level, absolutely.
Really?
Because don't get me wrong, the first few episodes are a little bit of a slow burner. And obviously, you know, I'm not going to be breaking any spoilers or anything like that, but there's always a point of like, that's it, it's over. And then all of a sudden, it's like, whoever wrote it, I can't remember the name, whoever wrote it is a goddamn freaking genius, because it, every episode I'm like, well, I can't go to bed now on that. And, you know, you get stuck in that, you get stuck in that thing where you are sitting, you know, in bed watching it till 5 a.m. in the morning because it's so engrossing. I highly, highly recommend it.
Okay, I'll give it a second chance, because I do love Breaking Bad. That is, you know, that kind of set the benchmark for modern TV, really, didn't it? That show.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I only got into it kind of when, was it season 5 or season 6 was coming to the end, which was the final season, and I only really kind of got into it then, so I had missed the hype, as it were. But then kind of when I was watching through it, I was just like, I wouldn't be able to cope, like, having to wait another week for an episode of this. It definitely set the benchmark, like you say, for a modern, drama. Drama would be the best way to word it. Money Heist is absolutely up there. Absolutely up there. And as soon as I finish that, I'm on to Boba Fett. I love my Star Wars. I love my Star Wars. So we are coming to like the end of the time frame for the podcast. So you are the first person to actually be a recipient to a... I've got to check the story. Well, you're the first person I'm doing it with, but because I had to delay another episode, I had to go to speak to that guest on Instagram and say, look, I've got Phil on. You need to ask him a question.
Oh, right.
Because the new segment is the guests ask a question for the next guest and so on and so forth.
Okay.
Yes. So your question comes from Stephen Ward from Neural DSP. Are you aware of him?
I should say yes, because I am endorsed with Neural DSP. I know Max.
Yes, Max.
Let's edit that out. So,
okay. Well, Stephen, if you are going to be listening to this, I apologise. But obviously, Stephen is their content creator on YouTube.
Okay, yeah. So he will have edited. Yes. He'll have edited the preset video that I did for them.
Yes, because I have all your presets on my quad cortex and I'd really enjoy them.
Oh, well, thank you.
And I'm not saying that because you're the guest on here, but I genuinely do really like them. The sort of sounds I would tend to go for. So the first episode of the season was with Jake Wilson. Jake dropped one to Stephen and Stephen to you. And then you will drop one for our next guest, which I will tell you in just a moment. So your question from Stephen is, what's your favourite failure that has led you to success? Which is a great question.
Favourite failure that has led to success? Oh my word. That's another deep question, which is great. But man, I'm going to have to think about that for a minute. I mean, I can think of a lot of failures, but I can't think of ones that maybe have necessarily... Oh, actually, I can tell you one. I'm sure there are many others, but this is one I can immediately think of. So originally, I wanted to study music at Leeds College of Music, and I didn't get the grades that I needed to get in, and they wouldn't let me come. And moving to London was actually my second choice, and I took a year out because I come from a small town in the north of England and wasn't that excited about moving to a big city. So I thought, well I'll have a gap year first before I go and just have a break from, you know, exams and education and stuff and get a job and try and save up and buy a nice guitar for college.
Is that where the Friedman come in?
No, actually I had a Vigier guitar back then. The Friedman's a relatively new acquisition. I've only had those for about two and a half years, something like that. So sorry to answer the question, I'm rambling on now. Yeah, so I failed to get into Leeds College of Music, and that meant I moved to London. And if I hadn't moved to London, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now, and I wouldn't have the career that I have now.
So coming down to be a big city boy paid off.
It did. In the end. And now I love it, and I'll never leave.
To be honest, I would love to live in London, absolutely. But I'm from Birmingham, so, you know, I'm cursed with that for the rest of my life. So your question that you are going to be asking today goes to Andy Gillian from The Land Down Under. And obviously he does a lot of soundtracks for video games and bits and pieces like that. Are you aware of Andy?
Yes, I am. He was a fellow finalist for Guitar Idol 2016.
Ah, so your question can't be like, what does it, how does it feel to be like, you know, eating my dust or whatever? You're not allowed to rub it in.
No, I won't. That would be very mean. What would be my question for Andy? Firstly, can I just say, I think Andy, if he's listening to this, his content is amazing and he is a hilarious person. He's just so funny.
It's been such a nightmare trying to organise getting him on, because obviously of the time difference.
Yeah.
So we managed to find one, and so the shooting date for this will be next Friday. So next Friday evening. So I'm going to be starting it at 11 o'clock on the night. And obviously for him, it's going to be 10 a.m. So
yeah,
it's going to be fun.
Yeah, that would be a really good one. Do you know what I would like to ask him is...
And this is where I have to write it down.
Yes. So Andy has, to my mind, an incredible capacity to just create and churn stuff out and create and churn out tons of music. You know, and he's released quite a lot of albums in the last 5 years. You know, he's done his own solo album, he's done stuff with his old band that I know he's not playing with anymore. But so my question to him is like, how does he keep on getting inspiration to keep writing new stuff? And how does he not, like, because I hate everything that I do, and I'm always like, nope, that's rubbish, nope, that's rubbish, nope, that's rubbish. Like, how does he manage to, like, push past that as an artist, you know, because he's an incredible composer as well as being an amazing guitar player. And, you know, I'm often be like, man, how does he come up with all those amazing ideas? So I would love to know, like, how he keeps that creative engine rolling and doesn't let it run out of steam. I'd love to hear him talk about that. That'd be really cool.
I've written that down to sum it up in the best way possible. So obviously you won't know the answer until you listen to the podcast with your mum.
Indeed. Yes.
So it's a good way to keep in viewer retention. I think that was a smart idea.
Oh yeah, definitely.
I was like, you know what, that could be a good idea, because I follow a few other music podcasts and it's not really something that I see other people do. So I'm like, all right, I'm going to nick that idea. So if people, or if you are aware of last season, we ask the same 3 questions to every guest that we have on in the podcast. So the first of these questions is, you are on a desert island. You can take a pedal, a guitar and an amp with no budget. What are you taking with you? And yes, you can pick endorsements, equipment if you wish to, or you can just
pick anything,
whatever you want. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh man. It would be, okay, so I've got one of these on order, so I'm going to pick this guitar. I would take the guitar that I don't yet have, which is being built by Lux Tone Guitars, which is basically a Strat with a humbucker and a bridge and a Floyd Rose, which for me is like everything. Can do all the classic Strat type stuff, and it can rock out. And I love the sound of Floyd's as well as like the, you know, the fact that you can do bizarre tricks with them. So I'd take that. I think if I had to pick one, yeah, I think I would take a Marshall Plexi actually, and an 808, which I know people are going to roll their eyes at and be like, oh, that's like the most sort of boring thing ever. But as primarily a rock player, for me, like that sound is just historically the foundation of rock guitar tone, and it's just a wonderful thing. And there's so much awesome other stuff that's out there, but I love all of those older school players who recorded all their albums with that sound. So that
I must say, like, I have, hold on, one, I've got three guitars with Floyd Roses, and I love them. I think they're great fun. They're a pain in the arse.
They are. Times, they are. Yeah.
But once you've got them settling in right, they are great fun. Have you ever tried making the Pac-Man sound with the Floyd?
I have not actually. No.
You can make two types of Pac-Man sounds with the Floyd, and you can also make it sound like an elephant, which is also another good fun one.
Yeah, I like the elephant one, or the horsey, the neigh. The neigh's good.
Yeah. The elephant's always a good little trick if, like, I show people and I want to see a trick, and you just go, woo, and you're just like, it's always amazing. Secondly, what are you listening to at the moment on your preferred streaming platform?
Oh, that's a good question. I've been checking out, recently? I checked out the new Smith Cotson album, which came out not that long ago. That's really cool. So I've been enjoying that. Today I was listening to, what track was it now? I've forgotten the name of it already. Let me get it up right here. Oh yeah, Jake to the Bone by Toto. That is an epic, epic tune. So I've been enjoying that. And then what else have I been listening to? I've been listening to some old Vinnie Moore stuff as well. So I've been kind of going back, kind of listening to some older school players. And I've been listening to a lot of blues because I'm writing about it so regularly. And I was never, like, I never disliked the blues, but I was never, like, particularly drawn to it. But I'm starting to, now I'm listening to more and more of it and starting to discover some really incredible players. I'm kind of really starting to get into that whole thing. So I've been checking out a player called Chris Kane this week, who is just...
The name rings a bell.
Oh, he's amazing.
I'm not too familiar, but the name rings a bell.
Yeah, he's awesome. There's loads of really great live stuff. So I've been transcribing some of his stuff. There's a great video of him playing a bar in America somewhere with Kurt Fletcher. There's another one of him with Matt Schofield as well. And he's just sublime. It's just, you know, I was like, man, how do you, like, just the lyricalness and the musicality that he pulls out of what many of us consider to be, you know, basic stuff. It's just amazing. It's just so good. And it's been amazing for my own playing. I feel like, you know, it's made me sound a lot more melodic and lyrical and stuff, importing a lot of that into my own playing style. So it's been, you know, it's been really cool. But yeah, that's what I've been listening to.
It's a nice cornucopia of various different elements.
Yes.
Which is always good. And lastly, where can people find out more about you?
Yeah, you can go to my website, philshort.com, or you can find me on Instagram, philshortguitarist, and it's the same for Facebook. And I have a YouTube channel, which is still quite small and embryonic. So if you want to go and check out a random assortment of gear demos and random lessons on things, there's some stuff on there. So just search Phil Short and you'll find me on there pretty easily.
I must put my hands up and admit that I only just subscribed today. I apologize.
Don't apologize. That's great. Another subscriber. That's a win. That's great. Appreciate that.
Yeah. I'm at my 400 or so, something like that.
It's hard work.
Been stuck at like that for like 10 years.
Yeah, man, it's hard work. It's really hard work.
Yeah, the YouTube definitely over the last sort of 5 years has gotten a lot more difficult and a lot more, I think, saturated.
Yes.
Is the best way to word it.
Yeah.
And actually, it's a completely different point, but it ironically kind of touches on the same thing anyway. You know, the whole, all the kids nowadays, like, oh, I want to be a YouTuber, I want to be a streamer, and all these bits and pieces. And my mum, she works in a primary school. And again, all the kids are like, I want to be a YouTuber, I want to be like, you know, Fortnite, whatever, business. And I was saying, I'm a big motorsport fan outside of, you know, guitar playing and whatnot. And there's a Formula One driver who's racing for Ferrari, and he's got 6,000, 7,000 subscribers, I think. He's barely got any. And it's like, if he is driving for Formula One for Ferrari and he's only got 7,000 subscribers, what chance is a kid playing Fortnite in his bedroom, you know, in where, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It puts everything into perspective. And then if you want to pigeonhole it any further with guitarists, it's even more difficult.
Yeah, yeah. And there are some amazing channels out there with incredible production and great content and really informative and all that kind of stuff. So it can feel a bit like, oh, what's the point in me doing something? But again, that's, you know, that's a negative way to kind of see it. And so the way that I've decided to see it now is, you know, if it grows, it grows. I can't really control that. But I'm going to put stuff out there because that's just the world that we live in. You kind of have to put stuff out there. And I used to really stress about what to put out and be like, well, is it going to be good enough? And is it going to be as good as this person? And, you know, comparing myself to everything else that was out there too much, rather than going, well, you can only talk about what you know. So just do that. And it doesn't matter if somebody else has already talked about it. You're talking about it from your own perspective and somebody might find that interesting. And so far it seems to be working, going for that more chilled approach.
I always say quality, not quantity.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think if you want to try and grow numbers, the videos that I've done that have had the best response have just been gear demos, because no one's there for me. They're just there for the pedal or whatever, you know. they just want to know what it sounds like and stuff like that.
They want to know what a Strifecta sounds like.
Yeah, that's it. Should I blow, you know, 1,200 quid on those pedals or should I not?
Yes.
Do it.
Do it now. So, Phil, thank you ever so much for coming on Guitar Geeks and spending an hour and a half with us and divulging lots of random stuff, as we always talk about. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much. It has been a real joy. Appreciate being here.
It took a while, but we finally got there in the end. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on, and it's been really insightful to talk about, actually, you know, kind of the big time, so to speak, the big time side of music, which not many of us ever get to experience. So thank you, everybody, ever so much for tuning in to this episode of Guitar Geeks. All of the contacts for Phil will be in the description box. So his website will be there, his Instagram, his Facebook. You can check him out there. Also, make sure you check out some of his endorsements with Friedman, with Two Notes, with Victory, Hampstead. The collection is huge and he endorses them because they are the best products that are out there. You can find out more of me at The Corona Mortis on Instagram, and you can follow us on Instagram at The Guitar Geeks Podcast. Thank you once again, Phil, for being here.
Thank you, sir.
And until the next time, we shall see you all very soon. Take care.